Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and our panel discussion for this Friday. It is the 17th of July, and it's 12 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock. Thank you very much for being with us. I do appreciate you being here, and I know we all do. And it's going to be a hot weekend. Hopefully you're ready for a Friday. I know we all are, and we've got a lot to talk about and a wonderful group to do so. If you'd like to join us, all you have to do is go to your computer or your device of your choice and email us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Let me introduce the group to you, and we will get started. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you, sir?
Good morning. Every day is a challenge, and today is no different.
Okay. What's the challenge today? Do you mind?
I don't know. It'll happen.
All right. Hasn't happened yet, but damn it, it'll happen.
It always does.
Yeah, it always does. Well, wonderful to have you here. We welcome Judith Enck with us, former EPA regional administrator, visiting professor at Bennington College, and president of Beyond Plastics. Good morning, Judith. How are you?
I'm good. I know we're going to cover a lot of important topics, but I want to share that Buckingham Palace just confirmed that Princess Beatrice has gotten married in a private ceremony. I don't know if there will be photos.
I told you it was going to be a difficult day.
Yeah. Now that is Sarah and Andrew's child, correct?
Yes. Daughter, you royal family watcher, you.
Yes. Now, so, but Andrew, was he even invited into the castle? I mean, I know.
I don't think it was at the castle. I think he's in time out forever.
Yes.
And that may be why. That may be why it's a private ceremony.
Good. Oh, Alan, you always have the quick political analysis. I think you're right.
Yeah. Apple falling not far from the tree. They might have been afraid, but the daughter should never be held responsible for what happened to the father,
She should have a lovely wedding. No. And this has been planned for a long time, I know. So hopefully it was lovely. And hopefully, I'm sure they have a photographer somewhere around there in the royal family.
As soon as the show is over, I'm going to look.
And I think she's supposed to be the good one. I think people like her.
I think we like Beatrice. Yeah, I think you're right, Alan. All right, let's.
I should have just said good morning. Sorry.
No, you took us off the rails, but that's all right. That's fine.
We will get letters saying, "How dare you with these terrible things happening in the world?" And we have to have a little fun, don't we?
Yeah, we'll either get that. You're absolutely right, Alan. We'll either get that, or we'll get the other half, who will send us like the entire royal family tree, showing us where Beatrice fits into that. But right. I would like that.
I would like to receive that.
Both are fine. Oh, look who's on the show today. Oh, this made me smile. Kate McGuire is here, artistic director and CEO of the Berkshire Theater Group. Good morning, Kate. How are you?
I'm well. I was thinking when Alan was speaking about the challenges that every morning I get up, I turn the TV on, I think it's just going to be back to normal. This was all a dream. And lo and behold, Judith speaks about a wedding.
Yes.
We're back to, you know, we're back to normal in Judith's world, at least. Thank you, Judith, for that.
Oh, but don't get a false sense of security, because in about 2 minutes, she's going to burst your bubble and tell you how horrible the world is.
We are so lucky. We are so lucky to have Kate McGuire with us. She is a star of the Berkshires. No question with her wonderful work at all the theaters and Stockbridge and Pittsfield. Amazing.
We are thrilled, and we're going to get to some of the news that Kate has been making in the New York Times and other places all over the theater world.
Yay.
So we'll talk about that in a few minutes, too. Oh,
it's an honor to be with all of you.
Well, we love having you here, Kate. Our wonderful friend Jim Ketterer joins us as well, Bard Center for Civic Engagement, a senior fellow and dean of the School of Continuing Education at the American University in Cairo. Jim, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. It's nice to be back. I know that when Alan was saying with a deep sigh that every day that probably realized that, you know, Ketterer's back on the panel. So
yes, that's right. That's exactly what I had in mind. But I did have a secret question for you, and I had mentioned it to Joe before. When this morning on NPR, which you know I don't always respect all of their work, but they had correspondents talking about the COVID, and sooner or later, one of the correspondents was either in Egypt or Egypt was on the beat, and you're our Egyptian guy, and said it's a repressive culture, something like that. Is it?
Well, you know, it's the current president of the country comes from the military, and if you talk to Egyptians, there's great debate as to the nature of the regime. But there's a lot going on in Egypt that I know. Just in the news at the top of the hour, they were talking about Egyptian calculations with regard to the conflict that's going on next door in Libya, and then in the other direction, Egypt is in a long-standing conflict over Nile water flows with Ethiopia. These are both huge, huge issues. In addition to tackling the COVID crisis in Egypt, there's a lot of balls being juggled right now, and it's a difficult situation, multiplied many times over.
Literally and figuratively. But I did want to ask you, back seems to me when I was going to college and the dinosaurs were running outside, didn't Nasser try to, wasn't there going to be a United Arab Republic, including Libya, under his jurisdiction?
Well, Nasser and his overall view of kind of uniting the Arab world and transcending political borders and, you know, all that was right. Wrought post-Versailles Treaty. Sure, the United Arab Republic technically included Egypt and Syria for a few years. So there was that union that didn't last terribly long.
No.
And but if you look on old maps once in a while, you will see it, maps from that era. But there's a long border shared between Egypt and Libya, and the conflict there has drawn in many, many outside forces. And you know, after the UN approved move supposedly to protect Benghazi, that turned into a big political fiasco as well. And then the removal of Gaddafi, it's been an absolute meltdown ever since. And Egypt can't help but be affected because of geography. They're right there on the border.
I know.
Thanks for setting me straight. I really appreciate that.
I know what I didn't remember. A lot of elements to it.
Yeah. I know I ask you this question regularly. It's only because I'm afraid of losing you as a regular panelist, but because of the time change. But do you know if you'll be going back to Egypt anytime soon?
Yes, I am planning on going back. Part of it is just dependent on me getting over some knee surgery to be able to move through the traffic of Cairo, which is always a challenge. You know, the university is looking forward to kind of the next phase, kind of like many universities are here, doing a sort of a hybrid, most of the classes online, some in person, trying to sort through how to do it safely but effectively. And so I will be going back, yeah.
But we have
Don't. We find it inconvenient for you to go back.
We always love when you're here.
Alan, I'll have you write a note on my behalf. Doctor's note. Yes.
So let's talk about the coronavirus outbreak and what we're seeing is mask rules expanding across the U.S. as clashes over the mandates intensify. This becomes a story, of course. We've been talking about masks for a very long time, but I think it hit a new level this week when the governor of Georgia, Brian Kemp, announced that he was suspending all local mask mandates, filing a lawsuit on Thursday challenging the authority of leaders in Atlanta. So he's suing the mayor of Atlanta to require masks inside their city limits. I just want to repeat that more for me than for anyone else. But the mayor of Atlanta is concerned about the safety of the citizens of that city and is asking that people wear masks. The governor of the state is suing the mayor, telling her she can't do that. Okay. As the mayor of Atlanta, the suit said, Keisha Lance Bottoms does not have the legal authority to modify, change, or ignore Governor Kemp's orders, only to carry them out. Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt said this week that he remained opposed to a mask order even after he became the first governor known to test positive for the virus. All right, we'll let that sink in, and I'll go to Alan.
Well, you know, this is a particular disgrace because we have a governor who is saying in this case, I actually believe in wearing a mask. I think people should wear a mask. But this mayor is out of order because she, in order to protect her people, gave an order that I don't happen to agree with and is not within her jurisdiction. So as governor, I'm telling her to cut it out and I'm going to sue her for it. It's an extraordinary look into the way politicians think. Now, I'll be honest with you. Andrew Cuomo, on several occasions, has had real differences with Mayor de Blasio. And the mayor will make some announcement, and the governor will come on and say, that's not his job. That's my job. I make those decisions. Except in the case of Andrew Cuomo, he's on the right side. And in the case of the governor and the governor is on the wrong side, period.
Well, and it's a different thing to argue over how to open or close or whether it should be 1 week or 2 weeks and to talk about the safety of your citizens, of saying you don't have to mandate a mask. I just don't.
I keep saying the same thing. I say it every day when I wake up, and we have a cup here at Man's Chartok that says, I wake up every morning and Trump really is the president. You know, it is just unbelievable. It's unbelievable that it's come to this.
Judith Enk.
Yeah, I agree. It is particularly risky for store employees. So these heroic grocery clerks, you know, people who work in supermarkets and convenience stores, who are not getting paid a lot, who are expected to show up to work every day so we can get food. And there are two things going on. If the customers are not wearing masks, then the workers are exposed. Or the employees have to take on this major role of enforcing the store rules to wear masks. And we've all seen these bizarre videos of people flipping out when told right. to put masks on. You know, some in the private sector are you know, taking this on. I read this week that Walmart has said if you're not wearing a mask, you can't go in the store.
Walmart, Target, CVS, they've all...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they're kind of filling that vacuum. But, I mean, I think there needs to be a federal policy that everyone should wear a mask when they're in public. That's not going to happen. So then local and state government should be doing it. And it's unconscionable that a governor would actually go to court to file a lawsuit trying to block a mayor from protecting her constituents. I suspect this guy, the governor of Georgia, who beat Stacey Abrams largely due to voter suppression, I predict he will lose that court case, but he will make his political point to Trump and the Trump base that he tried really hard to make sure more people got sick.
And there was some murmuring that the reason this was being done, too, was a way of luring the Republican National Convention to Atlanta because they want to do it without masks.
Yeah, well, good luck with that. They also have two very competitive U.S. Senate seats up this November, and it'll be interesting to see how the COVID issue affects the outcome of those Senate races.
Kate McGuire,
all of this is another way of denying scientific evidence, correct?
I mean, it's about denying scientific evidence, that denying Dr. Fauci, denying there is a climate problem. I mean, that is what all of this is about, right? Because otherwise, it just doesn't make sense.
Right.
Yep. You know what's so interesting about that, Kate, is the way in which the Trumpers have been accusing people of using the science as if science was a bad thing. And they have made the case, you know, we don't listen to those scientists because, you know, basically they don't know what they're talking about. It's amazing.
I don't want to, and I want to get to Jim, too. We probably will do it right after the break, but I don't want to be all negative here. There have been a tidal wave of new mask requirements that have been issued in the last few days amid the cases. I mean, we can argue if it's too little, too late, but the fact is it's being done, and that seems good to me. Even though, I mean, we hit a new record yesterday of 75,000 new coronavirus cases across the country. We've never seen numbers like that before. More than half the states have issued statewide mask requirements, including Arkansas, where Governor Asa Hutchinson, a Republican, announced a face covering requirement on Thursday after previously taking a more hands-off approach. Governor Jared Polis of Colorado, a Democrat, also issued a mask order on Thursday after questioning whether such a mandate would be enforceable. But as we note, there still is firm resistance in many circles, including from some Republican leaders who view mask requirements as a threat to personal liberty. I'm going to hold there. When we come back, we'll go to Jim on this, and then we'll take your letters as well. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Judith Eng, Kate McGuire, and Jim Ketterer make up the program this morning. We welcome your input. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us. We have been talking with our panel about masks and how rules are expanding across the country, even though as clashes in some parts of the United States are intensifying as well. Jim Ketterer, I promised you a first word on this when we return. Go ahead.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I think a couple of things come to mind from these many stories. One is that Americans don't, I think, spend a lot of time thinking about how their complex system of government or governments at different levels really work. And so we see, you know, clashes and tensions between mayors and governors and the federal government, and how does all that fit together? And, you know, I think it's another reminder that people should not take these things for granted. It matters who's in these offices at every single level. It matters that they be held accountable after Election Day. People need to turn out, vote in an informed way. These things just don't happen by themselves. And I think with the system under such incredible stress now, you do kind of see it highlighted, these tensions built into the American system. And I think it behooves all of us as citizens to pay close attention, to be involved in any way that we can and be informed. The second part to what Kate was saying, too, the question of people, the mask, not wearing a mask, the denial of science, the death of expertise, to quote the title of a great book from a couple years ago by Tom Nichols. I mean, this has been brewing for a long time, and it's really coming to the fore. And it just strikes me that, you know, in a way, it's as bad as it is now. Imagine playing this forward a few months into a long, dark, cold winter time when people are stuck inside, when the amount of casualties from this terrible virus continue to grow, where, you know, doctors now who are getting sick, nurses, other medical personnel have to go offline because they can't function anymore. I mean, this really could get, for a long time, very, very ugly. And the people who are in denial about things like wearing masks or that COVID-19 is a hoax, I think that they have insulated themselves from being convinced otherwise, unless and until they are personally and directly affected by this. I don't think there's any talking them out of their positions.
Judith, what do you think about that? Because it seems, it does seem difficult.
Yeah, and it's so familiar to me in terms of climate change and climate science. I mean, I think all the medical doctors and epidemiologists are now having the experience that climate scientists have been having for the last 15 years. I mean, we've known about the incredible risk of climate change for well over 35, 40 years now. So, you know, this is just terribly, terribly familiar. And I think what Jim described is the winter we have coming up. I often think, as worried as I am today about so many people suffering, you know, over 70,000 new cases reported in the U.S. yesterday, as you just said, Joe, you know, in the Northeast, we can go out, we can be in our gardens, we can take walks, we can see friends, in my case, 20 feet away outdoors with a mask, because I triple the CDC recommendation of 6 feet. But, you know, what's January going to be like? Those Zooms are going to really go south.
Yeah.
People are not going to be happy.
And it seems difficult not to be, at least for those of us who are talking this morning, it just seems to be difficult not to be very wary and concerned and, well, dare I say, even depressed over the way this is going.
I told you.
Yeah. Oh, the... Yes, you did. You absolutely did. You warned me.
You know, we're getting a ton of letters, Joe, from people who are saying the coronavirus will play into Trump's hands to call off the election, to conspire to make the election not happen. And I think we already see some of it in terms of his opposition to mail-in ballots, the rest of it. But there are an awful lot of people who are convinced he is going to use this to load the game. Now, you know, we can talk about conspiracy theories, but among others, Joe Biden is warned of this.
Yeah, yeah. And also, I mean, I guess, and there's the other way of looking at it, too, is that a lot of people, I mean, as the numbers are telling us, if they're to be believed, that people, the majority of people are extremely distressed. Three quarters, the latest poll I saw, over three quarters of the people think that we're handling this wrong, in a wrong way.
Or as we say, wrongly.
Wrongly, yes. Let's go to some letters. Kathy says, I don't think the compulsory mask argument is about denying science. It's about denying that there is anything resembling a collective in our individualistic country. As Margaret Thatcher said, and the Republicans believe, there is no such thing as society, only individuals and families. Mike says, I wear a mask anytime I know that I cannot practice social distancing. I applaud Governor Cuomo for making it mandatory for customers to wear masks when entering a store. That has been helpful, I think. Though since he announced that executive order, I've been noticing customers wearing a mask to enter a store, then pulling it down, uncovering their nose or mouth or both while shopping. Once in the store, I do not see any employees attempting to require these jerks, his word, to wear their mask properly. These yahoos may think they are expressing their individual rights, but they are nothing more than self-absorbed fools. Charlie says it's clear that the GOP made a calculated decision to allow COVID-19 to devastate densely populated southern cities made up of mostly Democratic voters in yet another in a long line of attempts at voter suppression. This craven, criminally negligent policy is only the only motive for a complete failure of state leadership, including Georgia Governor Brian Kemp's lawsuit to block the Atlanta mayor's life-saving attempt to mandate mask wearing, and the media is failing to connect the dots. I don't know, Alan, do you think the media is failing to connect the dots?
Well, I don't know about the media, but I reject it when it comes to me. I certainly have been connecting dots all over the place. So, and, you know, people have been saying, okay, give it up already. You don't talk about this anymore. We all know what you think. No, we have the worst. We not only have the worst pandemic, certainly in my lifetime, but we also have a guy who wants to bring what I consider to be fascism and totalitarianism into our American experience, into our lives. I truly believe that that's what he's got in mind. And if that's the case, you can either go out in the streets and do something with a pot and a pan or whatever, or you can keep talking about it, because if you don't talk about it, it sure is going to happen.
Sandra writes to us and says the lieutenant governor of Georgia was just on CNN speaking for the wearing of masks. He said he was unaware the governor happened to be holding a press conference as he was having an interview. The two at the top do not appear united. Do we think their governor will be gone soon?
Probably well, he's, not. He's made a major mistake, right? I mean, you know, what a fight to pick with a mayor over wearing masks. He should be saying we're all in this together and we need to. And we need to, you know, respect, we need to save ourselves. That's simple.
Who on the panel thinks it's possible? Go ahead, Jim.
I just was wondering how much of the attack on the Atlanta mayor might also be calculated, because she appears to be in the running to be a VP choice for Biden. And is this some way to try to undermine her chances, or to... You know, is there somehow presidential politics involved in some of these calculations?
That's a brilliant, brilliant insight. And I know it because I was thinking the same thing.
But it
<Free mind.
laughs> but it also, I mean, it brings her on the other side of the political spectrum. I mean, it also brings her great. I think people look at her as standing up to this and puts her in a very good light, doesn't it?
With?
Yeah, depending on what your political leanings are.
Right, I mean, those. I mean, it does seem, if it's true that the majority of people believe that wearing masks is the right thing to do, and that's what she is saying, that seems like it would be helpful.
You know, Joe, when we talk about this stuff, I don't know if you saw Rachel Maddow last night.
Yep.
Introducing or interviewing Mary Trump. If that wasn't enough to scare whatever you have inside of you out of you, I don't know what is. I mean, just what a brilliant woman. She said it right. She was right where she should be.
She came across as so credible and so smart. And I think if our listeners did not watch that interview, it's worth going back and watching. It's the full hour. It was riveting. And yes, I mean, we kind of knew some of these problems with Trump's worldview, but she laid
and
it out and
narcissism.
Handled it so well. Yeah.
We did hear that. I mean, the big headline to come out of that interview, of course, was the fact that she said that she had personally heard him use the N-word and use other racial and anti-Semitic slur. Yeah. All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation with our wonderful panel, Alan Chartok, Judith Enk, Kate McGuire, and Jim Ketterer. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Hey, listen, it's some music from Godspell. How cool is that?
It's cool. It's cool. And we get more letters about our music than virtually anything else.
It's great. Kate, tell us about Godspell.
Whoa, tell me. Well, it's been quite a little journey to Godspell.
So
I just want to
set this up just for a second, because the headline here is that the Actors Union, this is the first in the pandemic, they're allowing two shows to go on. So Actors Equity is agreeing to allow a few of its members to perform on stage, and one of the productions is Godspell. At the Colonial. Well, not at the. It's in Pittsfield, in a outside, right, Kate?
Right on our property at the Colonial, right adjacent in our parking lot. We're putting up a tent, and I think I had mentioned the last time I was with you that I was working trying to figure out what could be done to our theatrically starved community. And I began working with the union, with the Actors Union, at the beginning of May. And I worked with them for a couple of months on the phone daily into the evening hours. I mean, it was an amazing process and one that I learned so much, and I'm so grateful for the process. We put together a 30-page manual. I feel like the only place that something like this is possible is outdoors. And so finally, we reached an agreement. The actors will be arriving next week for rehearsal. They'll also be rehearsing outdoors. And we will be presenting the musical Godspell with so many iconic songs. And probably at this point, my favorite of all of them is a song called Save the People.
Yeah.
The rest of the season of plays that we were doing had to fall away. They were shows that needed to be inside. They were shows that demanded large sets. They slowly but surely fell away, and Godspell was the one that I held onto, and we've found a way to bring it to our audiences with security and safety in mind first and foremost.
You're going to have a 10-person cast, and we should note that the musical itself is going to be set in this year during the coronavirus pandemic.
Correct. It's Godspell. It's the parables. It is about a group of people, each of them in crisis, coming together to meet with the philosopher named Jesus, a leader and a guide, and trying to find their way back to each other and asking the question, what the heck is going on in the world right now?
Right. So let me...
And so, go ahead.
I was just wanted to ask the question of what do you think we can learn from what you have gone through in dealing with actors' equity and dealing with unions? I mean, mm-hmm. as schools are dealing with this, as companies are dealing with this, as really the whole country is dealing with this, of trying to get back to normal, of whether it be the arts or education or any number of pursuits, that what you were able to do to work with them to allow the safety of the audience, of the performers, and also to even, because even in the head of the union is quoted as saying in the New York Times, you know, the fact that there was going to be an equity approved theater this summer was something that she thought was undoable.
Right. They, Actress Equity, to their credit, hired a doctor to work with us. And we worked closely with their health and safety director. It came down to three things: testing, distancing, and masks. So the actors will always be 10 feet apart on the stage. They will be tested 3 times a week. And while they won't be wearing masks during the show, the stage will be 25 feet away from the audience. The set is being designed in such a way that there will be screens, if you will, that are part of the set and beautiful, but will be there to protect the actors also when they're singing. We're bringing the musical back to its original form, if you will. So when Godspell was created, it was a very folky kind of sound.
Right.
We only have 3 band members and no wind instruments. And the actors will be amplified, so they're not having to sing over a large rock band. It'll be back to its original form, which was a simple, beautiful piece. And the audiences also will be distanced. So if there's 2 in your party, you'll be apart from the next party. We'll arrange the seats under the tent each day according to the audience numbers and the parties that are coming. As audience members come, they all have to have masks. As they walk in, they'll be distanced from each other. And temperatures will be taken. We're taking information for contact tracing. So what we did was we just kept looking at the science. And what I will say is that the manual that we put together is a blueprint for hospital. We also have the Naughton family coming to visit us in about a week for a concert under the tent. But this manual is a blueprint for August 2020 theater under a tent. I imagine that another manual will have to be created for whatever we can do in the fall or in the middle of winter, because this virus is ever-changing, the science is ever-changing, and we certainly recognize we have a responsibility. The question that I'm asked most is, why are you doing this? Why didn't you just stop? My family would say, because she can't. She can't stop. People bananas. But I felt like we could accomplish something. I sit outdoors and, you know, go over to the tavern at Shaker Mill in West Stockbridge and sit out there on a picnic table and feel quite safe. I'm distanced from people. I'm outside. And I thought, I think I can do this. And I also felt like it was a way in to begin theater in a community that is fairly secure right now because people are being smart. So we certainly recognize the responsibility that we're taking on because we want to keep our community safe.
I have two quick questions.
Yo, can I just mention one thing?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I just wanted to, number one, applaud Kate for doing this. You know, I know so many personally in the music community, musicians across upstate New York who have been put out of work, and they have no idea. They've lost so many performances. They're trying to do things online. They're doing some outdoor performances. It's really very, very tough on people who make their living in the arts. But I think it's also, hearing Kate talk about this, it's a reminder that the arts are not just a luxury. They're not something we can kind of get back to when everything is sort of normal again, whenever that might be.
Mm.
But they're an important, it's not just entertainment, they're an important expression of what's happening in our society and what's happening now in our society. I think they're needed all the more. And so finding a way to make it happen, I think, is just so incredibly important.
Harry Clark is the other show that is going to be performed in the Berkshires, that by Barrington Stage Company. And were these separate pursuits, or were you all working together with Actors Equity?
Julie and I talked quite often during this process. Obviously, what we're doing is different. Harry Clark will be performed indoors, so her needs and her setup is different than ours. And I think what was most important, the most important thing I realized was that the process was critical, that I may have to throw away this 30-page manual that I worked on every day for 2 months. But Actors Equity and I are continuing discussions with other theaters, with Dr. Michaels, who they brought in to consult. And we will continue to talk about the way to get performers back on our stages, because our industry, as Jim was saying, our industry is going to be devastated. And I am well aware that everyone is under duress. But I'm wondering, you know, when do I get a seat in front of Congress, or when do my peers get a seat in front of Congress to say, could you please get some money to the NEA to get to local arts councils, because we're going to be wiped out? It's a dire situation for much of what's going on is dire.
Yeah, and I certainly don't want to. I don't want this to be perceived like I'm throwing cold water on anything. Do you look at it though? You have this manual. You have a plan. All systems ago. You have the cast coming in, but I guess there always has to be the realization that reality could come in and stop it at any time, right?
That's correct. Absolutely correct. But we wake up in the morning and we realize that now, don't we?
Right.
In our daily lives. And so we've created a plan that The actors will all be living together in one household. They each have their own suite. Each part of the theater is in what we call a bubble. So the technical folks are in their bubble. There won't be interaction between within some of the bubbles. And when there is, it's distancing and masking and lots of testing going on. The actors have one costume. There won't be costume changes. There's no props in the show. So a lot of those pieces have been eliminated in order for us to afford to be able to give all these tests to the actors.
Right.
So we
only have about a minute, and my final question, then we'll move on, take a break, and then we'll come back and talk about other dire stuff. But so I don't know how to say this nicely, but I mean, at the end of the day, when this is all over and assuming it's a rousing success, then you sit down and you say to yourself, was it all worth it?
I think it's worth it for the arts, for all of to be together again, to hear voices, to hear the words of the artist. And I also remember it was the Middle Ages that brought us the Renaissance. And so when this is all over, I'm hoping that the age of the artist will appear.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue, and we will go on with our wonderful panel. Alan Chartok, Judith Enk, Kate McGuire, Jim Ketterer. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and our panel discussion. Your letters are welcome, panel@wamc.org. Let's go to just a few letters, and then we'll move on to some other things. Sandra writing about I think I already read that one. Eric writes, who on the panel thinks it's possible that the Trump and the GOP with Kemp and DeSantis are intentionally allowing Did I read that one before?
No.
Okay. So who on the panel thinks it's possible that Trump and the GOP with Kemp and DeSantis are intentionally allowing COVID-19 to spread throughout the U.S. population, especially now that Trump is blocking the CDC from receiving hospital data on cases and deaths? Alan?
Well, it does seem absurd on its face to think that any human being would do that. And yet we now know so much, thanks to Mary, Trump and others, about the psychological makeup of this guy, that it is not beyond the area of possibility. Do I think that... that he sits there and goes, I'll wipe out the population of these big cities because they're Democrats and they won't vote? I would think not. Never. I would hate to think so. But with him, with this guy who is, in my mind, a psychopath, anything is possible.
All right. Here's a question for everybody. And we can go around, do a round robin here. This is from Colin. It's a very simple question, but it's a good one. I'd be very curious to hear panel members discuss how they think we can reestablish trust in government, in education, in science, in our society, as in literally what to do. Who would like first crack?
Well, I think the most important thing is to get Trump out of office because he's so toxic for the entire culture. And then it's going to be a long haul back. I mean, I listened so carefully to Kate describing what she was doing and her point that after the Black Death in Italy, we had the Renaissance, which was one of the greatest times for art and also architecture and literature. I think we will see that. I also think that, we'll talk a little bit about climate change. You know, Biden has a chance to be the new FDR. So I think the way you regain trust is by actually doing the hard work and pulling people together and making people's lives better. It's not an academic thing. It's you've got to show results.
Alan?
Well, I agree. I think Judith is exactly right. I was going to say it before she said it, but, you got to get this guy out of here. And any thinking, decent group of people will begin to repair this incredible damage, which will take years to repair. that has been done. We've been getting all kinds of letters like, the first thing Biden should do is increase the Supreme Court by 2 members to make up to, for what Mitch McConnell has done. You know, I think you have to be very careful about that kind of thing, because FDR, who was one of the most popular presidents in history, found out the hard way that Americans don't like that. So, you know, I get it. I know what the request is here. But on the other hand, I think you don't want to make political mistakes which will just allow this crowd to come back in here.
Jim, when it comes to trust, what do you think? How do we regain it?
Well, I think we need, first off, we need a very kind of deep analysis of what has gone wrong. And while I agree that, you know, Trump is a big part of the problem, he's not the only part of the problem. These questions of, you know, disagreeing that science is valid, you know, forgetting that experts have any value, et cetera. This, as I said before, this has been brewing for a long time. And why is that the case, and what is going on? I also think that our goal shouldn't be that we should get to a point where we all agree on everything. That's just not going to happen. That's not a realistic vision of society. But the question is, how can we better disagree? How can we do it in a way that's civil, that's constructive, that is not the sort of thing you see happening all the time on social media? So what has really gone wrong? Trump, I think, is a part of the problem, but he's also a symptom of a deeper problem. And we really need to think hard about what that deeper problem is before we can solve it.
Kate.
I think that, you know, what I'm hearing from everyone, which I totally agree with, is that it's about education. I think also it's about personal responsibility and a sense of integrity in how we speak to each other and how we listen to each other. I think that one of the things that will come out of this, at least for me, is that I am listening to people in an entirely, I listen more deeply now, perhaps because I have the time. I don't know that reestablishing trust in government, I don't know that we've ever entirely trusted our government. And I don't think it's a bad thing that we keep a close eye on what's going on there and structures of power. But it gets down to the personal and each individual sense of responsibility about helping solve the immediate problems one step at a time in front of us, because it all needs to be looked at, as Jim was saying. There's a lot to consider now. It's going to take a long time, isn't it?
Yeah. But we don't even, and I was struck by what Jim was saying, because we seem to be having, as we were talking about the mask discussion, we seem to be having trouble trusting each other, of just what we're doing, that we're all on the same page and we trust one another.
Well, I think I have a little bit of a different view. I mean, the mask issue has become so politicized, but before Trump could make wearing masks a partisan issue in the beginning of COVID, think back to March. I mean, it's kind of amazing that people stayed in for months and followed direction. And, you know, that was, I think, a big sense of community. People wanted to protect their own health, but also their families and their communities. And that happened really quickly. And in the beginning, people were wearing masks. You know, I agree with Jim. It's not just Trump. It goes much deeper. And we should talk about the role of big money in politics. Who has the millions to get elected? Who doesn't? But I thought the country was doing pretty well responding to the crisis until Trump mucked it all up. A year ago, no one would have predicted that all of New York City would have stayed indoors for close to 3 months.
Right. Let us move on to other subjects. I want to talk about this week. We got the Biden plan, a $2 trillion climate plan. The plan connects tackling climate change with the economic recovery from the coronavirus, while also addressing racism. The proposal drew praise from his one-time critics, And it is, again, $2 trillion over 4 years to significantly escalate the use of clean energy and transportation, electricity, and building sectors, part of a suite of sweeping proposals designed to create economic opportunities and strengthen infrastructure while also tackling climate change. Judith, what do you think?
Well, I think this is Biden's moment to be FDR. He's going to have to come in with some very bold and workable proposals on the climate crisis. And I think the plan has some very good points, but you won't be surprised to learn that there are areas that I think need to be changed. The goal of carbon-free electricity by 2035 is terrific. It's actually 5 years quicker than New York's plan. New York has a law signed by the governor, Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act. And the Biden plan is more aggressive than that. So hopefully the state plan will change. It's very strong on environmental justice. I'm really interested in the part where he supports legal action to hold fossil fuel companies accountable for climate change. And it has, you know, the long list of new building codes for zero emission buildings, electric charging stations, a civilian conservation corps. That's all good. You know, I'm a detail person. So, you know, part of the details still need to be developed. What he released was a press release and an executive summary, but the details are to follow. There are some problems with the plan. For instance, he calls for new small modular nuclear reactors. I don't think that's a good idea. He is still supporting fracking, which I think is a huge problem. You know, many of the climate plans called for an immediate ban on fracking. This one doesn't. Biden was recently talking about how he's going to keep fracking. You can't solve the climate crisis if you are still hydrofracking. So the details matter, but I think this has great potential to position Biden in a way like, you know, the Green New Deal attempts to do. He doesn't use those phrases, but there are certainly elements of that. So it needs work, but I think it's really encouraging.
I hate to be, a practical political person, but do you think, Judith, I just don't want to ask this as a question, that Biden talks about continuing fracking because if he doesn't win 10th Pennsylvania, he might not win the election?
Mm. Yeah, I think that's right. But he's also been a big supporter of fracking. So that is a problem. Pennsylvania and Ohio have a lot of fracking, and a byproduct of fracking called ethane is being used to manufacture plastics. So it's also connected to plastic production. I think it would be hard for him to be clearly pro-fracking in Pennsylvania and Ohio and then reverse that after November. So that is a worry.
Details.
Yeah. But of course, it's a million percent better than what we've got today. Sorry, Jim.
No, I'm sorry. I wanted to ask you, Judith. I think that the fracking issue also overlaps with my part of the world, and that, you know, it's oil prices now, which have gone way down. It's it's a different global economy, and fracking appears to be much less viable. It does appear that some of the members of OPEC are working hard to make it to make fracking less viable. So it's a different time than when the Obama administration supported fracking and supported nuclear also. I wonder if, though Alan may be right about the politics of it, if in terms of the global economics, Biden is out of step on this.
Well, you can't do anything unless you win. Right. I mean, I'm sorry about bringing up this imperative of winning. There are things you say in order to win. And I think Pennsylvania is very tricky, and we've seen that before.
Sure have.
Well, that's why we have this like ridiculous federal subsidies for corn ethanol, is
exactly.
Only because Iowa is an early voting state.
Exactly. Yeah.
But in terms of the climate crisis, we can't continue with corn ethanol and we can't continue with fracking. So let me put my vote in for just Biden wanting to win Pennsylvania and Ohio, and then he'll come to a more environmentally responsible position after he wins.
Your point is so well taken. The United States, who used to be dependent on the Middle East, I think Jim knows about this more than anybody on our panel today, used to be totally dependent on the Middle East, isn't anymore because we have our own oil. In fact, I think one analysis I saw, you'll all correct me, I'm sure, if I'm wrong, said the U.S. is just about the cat's pajamas when it comes to how much we've got.
It is the cat's pajamas and the planet warmer.
And as I said, the Saudis and others are actively on the side of the anti-frackers because they have their own economic interests at play. They would like to undermine this industry. So, you know, strange bedfellows in these politics.
Indeed.
This week, this from the New York Times, this week President Trump and Joe Biden have staked out dueling positions on the climate. Biden proposed the $2 trillion plan that we talked about. Trump has continued weakening environmental rules and said Biden's plan would, quote, kill our energy totally and force 25% of U.S. companies to close. In past campaigns, this contrast would have made some Democrats nervous, especially during an economic downturn. Today, though, party leaders increasingly believe that the climate is politically helpful to them. John Podesta, the longtime Democratic official, says he thinks Trump was walking into a trap by continuing to highlight the issue.
Well, you see, the thing is that I don't think you've ever heard me say this before, but I'm going to point out something that I think is terribly important.
Yes, sir.
Trump is a lying liar. and so that anything he says now is seen as suspect. He has no credibility. So if he says something like 25% or 50%, you know, I don't think a lot of people believe him anymore. They have watched him kill, and I'm saying it, kill tens of thousands of people because he was such a jerk that he couldn't see the forest for the trees and set this thing up right so that we could have some preventative mechanisms or deal with this correctly. I don't worry about anybody believing him anymore.
Well, remember, he was also going to bring back the coal industry, and thankfully he didn't. But, you know, his war on the environment continues. We've got over 100 regulations out of the EPA and Department of Interior that he's trying to roll back. Thankfully, he's mostly losing in court. But I think, you know, voters care about not only climate change, but local clean air issues. Look at what's going on in Norlite, hazardous waste incinerator in Cohoes, where they've been burning toxic waste. And by the way, Governor Cuomo has a bill on his desk, soon to be on his desk, that would prevent burning the most toxic PFAS chemicals at the Norlite incinerator in the city of Cohoes. You know, there would not be progress on that if local citizens didn't pay attention and mobilize. Same thing with the Lafarge cement plant right on the Hudson River in Queens, where they want to burn millions of tires. And local people with limited resources have come together. There's now a bill in front of the Albany County Legislature, the Clean Air Act, that would prohibit that. So people get it. And
How many people get it? You know,
I think
my frustration is that while you're right in these incidences, and you certainly are right in everything you're saying, I just think that people are not as supportive of environmental change as they are of other things that are in their face at this moment. You know, I'm quite sure you understand exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I do. And, you know, I've been doing this work for a while, longer than I would like to admit. And when there are local environmental problems, people do come out and mobilize. I mean, it's really astonishing what people are doing on the Norlite hazardous waste incinerator problem and Lafarge cement plant. People get involved. The harder thing is climate change, when it's looked at more you know, from a distance. And because I want to be sharper on climate change, I'm actually going to do the Al Gore Climate Reality Project training that starts on Saturday. 10,000 people from all over country, all over the country. It used to be in person. It's their first virtual training for a week and a half to get really sharp on climate change. And for the very, I'm doing it for the very reason you put your finger on, Alan. How do we get people engaged and interested on climate change while we know the impacts are here now? You know, look at the weather forecast that Ray Graff just read to us for this weekend and sea level rise. And I, Kate, I worry about hot weather when you do your outdoor event. I hope the weather cooperates. But, you know, climate change is here, but most people think it's in the distance. So, you know, we've got to figure out how to communicate that.
Kate?
I was going to say, though, that one of the things about the Biden plan, which I think is promising, is that it is tied into tax incentives and new jobs. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really a plan to revitalize our economy. People do understand that. And so whether they're willing to sign on for the belief that something's going wrong in the globe, they're going to get it when there's new jobs created. Those are incentives that are real.
Kate, you know, I'm so glad you raised that. And, you know, the fastest growing job sector is wind and solar. And I think what Biden did in this plan, which is brilliant, is Trump will always say any environmental controls are job killers. Biden did the very smart and I might add accurate thing is talk about job creation opportunities from a clean electricity economy and clean transportation.
You know, I keep thinking about there's a plan to put a cell tower up in somewhere in Pittsfield right now. And your point about local opposition, Judith, is so brilliant, because I don't think that anything, not a future world war, nothing that's happening has gotten more letters to the Berkshire Eagle, which I read every morning, than opposition to this cell tower on environmental grounds.
Yeah, people pay attention locally, think globally, act locally. It's not, I mean, I'm concerned about people opposing solar farms and wind turbines. So we have to overcome that. But I also think that the more people paying attention, the better, because it improves the decision-making process. When I was at EPA, I always urged my staff when they went out for public meetings, listen with the intent to hear. You know, people, you may disagree with people, but the process, the churning process, often results in a better decision in the end.
We just have a few minutes before a bottom of the hour break, but Jim, any global perspective on this?
Well, you know, the global perspective, I think, and this gets back to the questions of trust and rebuilding things, is that there has been, over these last 3.5 years, a concerted effort to withdraw the United States from a variety of treaties, from participation in international organizations, from staffing State Department and USAID positions that would interact with those organizations on these issues. And you know, these are the sorts of issues that don't know national boundaries. You have to work cooperatively if you're going to make any progress whatsoever. And we have spent the last 3.5 years making it much, much more difficult to do just that.
Anybody? Okay.
Dead silence.
Yeah,
I'm an anybody, and it is completely
anybody.
It's completely nutty. I mean, the idea that we would pull out of the Paris Accords and that we would, you know, as if this world didn't need, wasn't interdependent, is just another part of Trump's inhuman, his inability to empathize, his inability to understand what any other need is other than his own. And, you know, I think your point is right on target, Jim.
Well, I would also add the Trump administration is a wholly owned subsidiary of the fossil fuel industry. I mean, the current EPA administrator is a former coal industry lobbyist. Yep. So they are doing everything.
That's bad, right?
Yeah.
that's bad.
Well, look, he really saved the coal industry, so he's really going to save our lungs also. But, you know, everything they do on climate and energy is to prop up and subsidize more coal, gas, and oil drilling, including on public lands. Joe, our friend Terry Tempest Williams in Utah is writing beautifully on this topic, that our public lands are now being exploited for more fossil fuel development. I mean, that's something that Joe Biden is very strong on and needs to, you know, reverse these leases as soon as, you know, day one, as soon as he takes office. We all pray. I pray in January.
We just have about a minute. I want to get to as many letters as I can right before the break. John says, I agree with Judith regarding fracking. However, Dr. Hansen, the father of climate change, is a strong proponent of small local nuclear power installations. Nick says, I cannot believe I heard Judith say that Biden could be the next FDR. The man that stated a Medicare for all bill is dead on arrival at his desk. A man who is for the fracking industry, a man who has been shown to abuse women. Please do not utter their names in the same sentence.
Disagree. I disagree with that letter writer.
Go ahead. Alan, did you want to say anything?
There's another letter, if I may, really quickly. Alan keeps forgetting. Alan says nobody believes Trump anymore. That may be true with a lot of people, but his base is totally immune to these revelations. We have to get to his base to come to the realization that Trump is evil. How do we do that? It's happening, Jeff, from Connecticut. It is happening. And in fact,
we see that
with the numbers. The numbers for Biden are going up. The numbers for Trump are going down. And there's no sense that it's going to get reversed anytime soon, which is why we're all afraid that he's going to try to steal the election, which I have no doubt he will do.
All right. We have to take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. Alan Chartok, Judith Eng, Kate McGuire, and Jim Ketterer. And Kate, I think you're going to have a poem for us when we come back.
I will.
We'll do that after this.
All right.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our last round here on the panel. Alan Chartok, Judith Eng, Jim Ketterer, and Kate McGuire joining us. We do welcome your letters. We have a lot to get to, a lot of letters to get to, and I'll get to those in just a second. You can add yours to the pile by writing to panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Kate, I know as you have been a guest over the past several months, you have been sharing a poem with us, which has been a lovely thing. And unlike other people who write poetry, who read poetry on this program, we actually can stay awake through it. So that's nice.
I know what you're talking about.
I know.
Thank you very much.
That was for you, Alan. Kate, what would you like to read to us this morning?
Well, I have a poem by Edna St. Vincent Millay, and just by way of introduction, first of all, Alan, the wonderful James Naughton sends his best regards to you. And normally when James is here, we've sat down and had nice meals. I miss being with all of you. I'm reminded of the sense of isolation in not sitting in your great studio right now. What would we do without WAMC? And in terms of sense of trust, none of us believed that we could be so abandoned right now by our leader in the White House. It is a time of isolation. 138,000 lives have been lost. And as Edna St. Vincent Millay said, I am not resigned to the shutting away of loving hearts in the heart. So it is, and so it will be for
Kate. Kate, you're fading out, Kate. Try repositioning the phone.
How's this?
Better.
Yeah, try it. You can start from the top. Yeah.
All right. I am not resigned to the shutting away of loving hearts in the hard ground. So it is and so it will be, for so it has been time out of mind. Into the darkness they go, the wise and the lovely. Crowned with lilies and with laurel they go, but I am not resigned. Lovers and thinkers into the earth with you, be one with the dull, the indiscriminate dust, a fragment of what you felt, of what you knew, a formula, a phrase remains, but the best is lost. The answers quick and keen, the honest look, the laughter, the love, they are gone. They are gone to feed the roses. Elegant and curled is the blossom. Fragrant is the blossom. I know, but I do not approve. More precious was the light in your eyes than all the roses in the world. Gently they go, the beautiful, the tender, the kind. Quietly they go, the intelligent, the witty, the brave. I know, but I do not approve, and I am not resigned.
Kay McGuire reading Edna St. Vincent Millay. That's beautiful. Thank you so much, Kate, as always. I appreciate it. That was gorgeous.
Great.
What was the name of the poem, Kate?
Dirge Without Music.
Ooh.
Thank you.
I like that. Dirge Without Music.
Not much music, as Jim was saying, in the world right now.
No.
Maybe I missed it, Kate, but very quickly, could you just talk about the Berkshire connection?
Oh, well, of course. Edna had a home very close here, didn't she, in Columbia County, and wrote much of her poetry here. And I think we could still go visit that house, can't we?
I think so. I'm walking distance from here.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what they're, you know, if they're open, but I know that they're, and that's a colony, right? A writer's colony as well.
Exactly. So
beautiful work that comes from there still. All right, a lot of letters. Let me get to them, and they'll probably bring us up to the end of the program. Kate says, another Kate says, a horrible situation, destruction of the coast, of feeding grounds for endangered species. I'm missing the point of this. This is on Norway's wind turbines. A horrible situation in Norway, destruction of the coast, of feeding grounds for endangered species. The turbines are huge and completely unnecessary. An instance of big overtaking the turbine industry. Who's behind it? Norwegian localities have been protesting with very little response from the government. I know nothing about that. Anything about... Judith,
yeah, there are controversial wind projects around the country, around the world, and so you've got to engage with the public early. But if we don't have large-scale wind and large-scale solar, we're not going to get out of the climate crisis, you know? So, you have to be smart where you site it, but I want big wind. I want big solar because we are running out of time to drive down carbon emissions.
We go then to Amy, who says, as someone who's worked with senior economic development officials in the state of Massachusetts to build the Berkshire's economy since 2004, I think having better cell service is crucial. People working at home and in cafes use cell phones and internet for their work. I want to know where the towers could be placed that would not be environmentally damaging. Oh, that's probably, there's at least three people on the panel who probably have something to say about that. Or no one.
I just pointed out there are more letters to the Berkshire Eagle about this than anything else. At least it seems that way. Yeah.
Protecting view sheds is important, and there are legitimate concerns about low-level radiation from cell towers. That said, there, especially today, we rely on internet and cell phones. And so, you know, again, bringing people into the process early and not surprising them, you should be able to site these things without destroying a view shed and without compromising health. But, you know, there are problems with the law. There's federal preemption, and local governments do not have enough voice. Either, you know, yes or no, there's not much legal real estate to figure out compromises when it comes to cell tower siting.
We go to David, who says, regarding the fracking issue, there is the issue of abandoned fracking sites due to company bankruptcies in the present oil glut. The abandoned continue to spew out methane, which is far more harmful greenhouse gas than CO2. U.S. taxpayers will be saddled with the cost of capping these abandoned wells. Eric,
could I
yes.
Read one? I've been a Roundtable listener, says Rick, for years.
I need you, Alan, just get a little bit closer.
I see what the problem is.
Okay.
Sorry, my fault. I've been a Roundtable listener for years. However, I have to turn you folks off for a while. I'm tired of hearing about how bad of shape this country is in and the constant Trump bashing. Please find something else to talk about. And I wrote back, which I tend not to do. I tend to put them in my PIA file. But I wrote back and I said, what's more important?
Mm, exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, we have a guy who's leading us into this fascism and dictatorship and totalitarianism. And you would rather we talked about something more important. What's more important?
138,000 lives have been lost.
Right.
It's a huge number.
It
Please
is
talk about
number.
Something more important.
I think
it's also sad to see that the listener is saying they're going to stop listening. They're going to turn it off, that we're saying things that they don't like. So instead of engaging the issues, getting into the details and offering something as a response, they're saying, I'm just not going to listen anymore. And I think that is so illustrative of the problem we face in this country.
But he did call us. He did write. Pardon me.
Yeah,
he did write to us.
And then said, "I'm not going to listen anymore."
And believe me, we've heard this before. And our numbers keep going up and up and up and up.
Pete says, "Firstly, we must refuse to have civil discourse. Firstly, we must refuse to have civil discussions with fascists. The wedding of corporate and state, this can no longer be tolerated and must be expunged from a humanistic society. Start there," says Pete. Christine says, "We don't need more study to figure out what's happening and how we got here and how to get back to us. Read Christoph's book, Tightrope." That's Nicholas Christoph for the New York Times. Especially the last chapter lays it all out, written with his wife, Cheryl Wudun. Willis says, "I'm 13 years old, and if we go back to school, I'll be very scared. I think if we don't feel safe and being masked in supermarkets is dreadful enough, imagine what will happen if we have to be learning in masks. I love the show. I've been listening since I was born. I'm quite a big fan of Alan." You always were big with the 13-year-old crowd.
That's right, and thank you for that very kind remark. I also heard from a devoted listener who says, and she's not kidding, I've become quite a comedian.
That was Willa, so thank you, Willa. That's cool.
Yeah, good luck, Willa. What a nice letter from a 13-year-old.
And sorry we screwed up your world. Bob says, "I think people's emotional well-being next winter will be tied to the election results. If Biden wins, then January will be a time for optimism and forward-thinking. Mm-hmm. If Trump wins, then I and many others will be crying and filling out Canadian immigration forms."
And we may not know on election day because of so many absentee ballots. I mean, we still don't know outcomes of some New York State races that took place.
That's right.
You know, a few weeks ago. So I think people should be mentally ready that we may not have results until December.
And remember that the pollsters got it wrong, except the last time, except that they didn't. Hillary got 3 million more votes. 3 million more votes, and somehow she's not president of this country right now. They were almost on target.
We have just a couple more letters. Mary asked this for Kate. How many people will be allowed under the tent at the Colonial?
100. That includes the performers. So we're setting up for 75 audience members each night.
Wow.
It's
a matter of privilege.
Well, that's cool, too, though. It'll be very, very intimate and lovely.
Yeah. And I think that we're going to be able to do some pop-up entertainment in Stockbridge on our campus there. We're working on plans for that. So, Alan, I have a stage for your comedy routine.
Well, that's great, and I'd like to come and do that. By the way, I love that Stockbridge facility. It is
the campus is lovely.
It's so gorgeous.
Sit on the grounds and enjoy a little music and Alan Chartok doing his comedy.
Yeah. Let me tell you about the one. Take my wife, please.
Why can't Eric ask this question? This is for Judith. Why can't politicians be honest? Wouldn't it be better if Biden was honest about ending fracking, but then promised to replace fracking jobs in Pennsylvania and Ohio with solar power factories and green energy jobs? I crave the honesty, and I'm tired of the nonsense.
Totally agree. And we're having that conversation locally, trying to shut down the Norlite hazardous waste incinerator and replace it with a giant solar field. I think, you know, if you say no to something, but you also say, here's something that's better, that will actually create more jobs and not poison neighbors, you know, people respect that, even if they disagree. So the letter writer is right, and I hope Biden does that.
All right, we have to go. We are out of time. My thanks to everybody. Alan, thank you very much. Have a great weekend.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks to Judith Enck, Kate McGuire, and Jim Ketterer. Thank you all. Have a beautiful weekend. We'll be back right after this.